asks. Was I bright and playful, affectionate and tractable? Tractable? My God, no. You were spirited and independent. And, of course, careful and wary when you were uncertain. You had to have been to survive living stray during the shortages of the war. When you felt safe, you were certainly affectionate, but you didn't give it away. It had to be earned. And that's what made me first love you. But in my writing to my old friend General Saxton, begging him to take care of you, I wasn't about to get into nuances. After all, he and my husband were on different sides, and as for whether you were bright, look at yourself now. My question is, what have you done with your brightness over the decades? I've been a teacher, James says. I've taught hundreds of children and adults reading and writing and arithmetic. Back when I started, a lot of my students were former slaves. It seemed like so many of them learned written language and understood the fundamental relationships of numbers almost overnight. They inhaled it like they'd been drowning and suddenly lifted their heads into the air. All they wanted was more. When you began classes with our tutor, you learned to read in a month, maybe less. You raced along, impatient to get to the next word, to the next line of text. Forward was your direction. So teaching must be a satisfying profession for you. It is. But the difference between a little boy learning to read in the president's mansion and a woman of 50 who'd been denied it by law for much of her lifetime is large. Yes, you're right. And teaching is truly a noble profession. Little money in it, though. I say that noticing your expensive footwear in particular. Blake tips his right foot at an angle to get a profile view, as if he hasn't noticed what handsome, gusseted, chisel-toe boots he wears. They shine like a mirror reflecting the night sky. He says, I get a discount. My wife's family owns clothes stores, a good business. In New York, they've just moved from San Juan Hill to Harlem, and in Philadelphia, they've been on South Street for 20 years. I'd like to meet her. Julie died almost 2 years ago. Consumption. But she was lucky, I guess. That translucent stage some people passed through lasted a long time for her, and when it faded, she finished quickly, without the worst of the hemorrhaging. Being close with her family has helped me through it, and maybe I've helped them some. They were generous before, and they're still generous now, and keep telling me I'm part of the family forever. They want me to join the business. I'm very sorry for your loss, Dee says. She pauses and says, maybe you should listen to them. Teaching is what I do best. Not manage a store or keep books or write advertising copy. I'm grateful to them, but I think I'm going to keep doing my job. Do you have children? No, ma'am. So you're totally free to move forward in life unencumbered, without needing to compound with your pride for the material interests of your family. I don't follow. I don't either. Never have. No matter how I parse the diction and grammar. Whether compound is noun or verb, I'm still puzzled. After the war, Jeff wrote it in a letter. I have compounded with my pride for the material interest of my family and am ready to go on to the end as may best promote their happiness. He's, of course, trying to blame me and the children for his fall. Guilt and pride nearly burnt our marriage down to the foundation. V tells James that Jeff's letter arrived at her dingy apartment in London during a long separation after the war, much of the time with the entire width of the Atlantic between them. Those oddly constructed words and clauses and phrases were how he informed V he had taken a job beneath him in order to support his family. His great sacrifice was to lower himself and become president of an insurance company after being president of a country, or a failed rebellion, or whatever label would be correct. The company covered the southeast, Baltimore to Houston. Many of his former generals, also broke, tried to make money writing memoirs, struggled to make themselves sit alone at a desk every day and conjure their version of history, constructed from the weightless tools of words and uncertain memory, and with a very uncertain payday at the end of the job. So they were eager to earn a steady salary in a more direct and concrete way as insurance salesmen and regional managers and that sort of thing. Go back to giving orders. V believes that General Hood was one of Jeff's insurance salesmen. Hood lost the use of an arm at Gettysburg, and afterward it just drooped there at his side.
And then a leg got taken off at Chickamauga,
4 inches below the hip. The doctor who did the sawing, as they hauled Hood away, put the leg alongside him in the ambulance, assuming he would die and would want it in the casket. But Hood didn't die. He came to Richmond and healed. He was barely over 30, a tall, slim martyr with a long, sad face made longer by his tangled beard. Mary Chestnut always said he looked like Don Quixote, or a crazed crusader fighting for crown and cross. He was shy with women, but battle lit him up wild as a Viking. Young Richmond ladies found him irresistible. But ever since the early days of the war, he had been under the spell of Mary Chestnut's good friend Buck Preston, who was beautiful and a genius at inflicting love. Hood gave a blockade runner leaving for Europe a brief shopping list for Paris. 2 cork legs, best quality, 1 diamond ring. When he presented the ring to Buck Preston, she declined his proposal. People accused her of being so shallow that she wouldn't marry him because he had 1 leg. Buck fired back that she wouldn't marry Hood if he had 6 legs. After the war, he found a woman other than Buck to marry, and in 10 years they had 11 children, quite a few of which were twins. Then, the yellow fever that killed half of New Orleans killed Hood and his wife the same day, leaving those orphans behind.
All that happened, James says? None of it, some of it?
All. But I got distracted from what I wanted to say to Jeff about compounding with his pride. I wrote back and told him that bad choices lead to bad consequences, like discussing misbehavior with a child. But he never accepted being wrong and never apologized for taking down our family, or 11 states full of families. He and his older brother Joseph were alike in that. A shared trait, never apologize for anything. Plow ahead, always believing you're in the right.
Go back, James says. You lived in London?
London, March 1874. The short stack of china stood only 5 dinner plates tall, each one chipped at the edges and crazed on the pink floral faces. 3 soup bowls, 5 teacups, but only 2 saucers. Glassware, just 4 stems, cloudy as an old man's eye. Bed and table linens and towels worn by time to an indeterminate color, like a teaspoon of coal dust in a pint of heavy cream. The color of dirty soles, and also the color of the plaster walls. The tiny fireplace might have been adequate for roasting a single sparrow over a fistful of twigs. V pulled open a cupboard drawer and found a sprinkling of mouse droppings. The oblong black nubs moved, like suddenly magnetized iron filings or swirled tea leaves, until they settled and found their pattern on the drawer bottom. Prophetic, but not subtly so. Just another message from the gods about diminishing expectations. The landlady, blade slim and a nose so long and sharp she had to angle her head to see around it, like a pelican, noted the drawer contents, and rather than being apologetic or embarrassed or making a joke, she swelled with antagonism, ready to start flapping with both long, bony hands if V objected. V walked to one of the parlor windows and looked up to the gray March sky, and down
into a narrow, cobbled street. Good indirect light for reading. The 3 flights of stairs would improve her health. If she leaned at just the right angle, she could see a thin slice of St. Paul's dome. All in all, not completely squalorous, but leaning toward. V said, "I'll take it." She moved in the next afternoon. Her things, all her holdings, fit in 2 travel-scarred steamer trunks with arched lids. She wiped out the mousy cupboard drawers and placed her books in stacks of 5 around the sitting room and bumped the comfortable chair a few feet nearer the window. Then she walked down the street. Within 4 blocks, she found shops to buy books and periodicals and bread and cheese and fruit and wine and glassine packets of morphine and small brown bottles of laudanum. She came back loaded with purchases and filled one of the clouded glasses with cheap Bordeaux and a few drops of tincture. She looked out the window, tracking the gradations of gray that marked sunset. Well past 40, fortunes lost, alone in London. She still received a few invitations to posh parties, but always declined because she no longer owned the correct clothes. The last time she had accepted had been nearly a year before, a luncheon with the rebel Princess Louise at Kensington Palace, though the minute V stepped out of the carriage, she felt too shabby to be there and vowed to stop pretending, to accept that lives rarely have plots, but sometimes they find shape, and that hers fell and rose and fell so often that she imagined drawing its graph and ending up with a cross-cut saw blade. V sat very still, soaking in the coal smoke, fog, rattle and thump of carriage wheels and horses' hooves, the shuffle of feet and murmur of talk below the windows. Why would she ever want to go home? Home had ceased to be. She had acquired and shed 4 or 5 houses, filled with fine furniture, paintings, decor, in Mississippi, Washington, and Richmond. But now those names represented only the vast category of things that come and go. Impermanence. Richmond never resembled home. During the war years, living in the president's mansion, which V preferred to call the Gray House, every day brought its own crisis. Life lived to the sound of blaring bugles and alarm bells. From a cold, gray ocean away, that past blurred. V remembered clear days, observation balloons of the Northern Army hovering to the east of the city like great malignant bulbs hanging high in the sky out of reach of the guns. At night, the multitudes of northern campfires lit undersides of clouds hazy amber. During periods of fighting, the sound of artillery rattled windows, even in the capital itself. One such day, the senators spent most of their time debating how many newspapers should be delivered to their desks, how often spittoons ought to be emptied. The war, sold to the people as a collective fantasy, became daily reality, a constant condition of life. Death and strange days stretching from the present instant to the farthest horizon you could imagine or even dream until at some point of weariness, war rests quiet in the mind. Sometimes, looking back, she wanted to claim, as Euripides and Stresorius did of Helen, that she had nothing to do with the destruction and tragedy of war, that an Eidolian took her place. Their radical variant of history proposed that the true Helen sat out the brutal messy years of the Trojan War in Egypt. V would have preferred London. Let her phantom deal with Richmond, its fall, and the desperate flight south. Let its blank mind deal with prison and the guilt of the war and the waste and the cost and loss for everyone. One late night, or early morning, toward the end of the war, she said as much to Mary Chestnut. Mary held her stem carefully between thumb and forefinger and lifted her glass to the ribbon of yellow and blue lamp flame. She studied and adjusted the dark liquid, establishing plumb and level. Mary sipped and said, "The Trojan War wasn't fought over a woman. Or are you still as romantic as ever?" Being on the wrong side of history carries consequences. V lives that truth every day. If you've done terrible things, lived a terrible way, profited from pain in the face of history's power to judge, then guilt and loss accrue. Redemption becomes an abstract idea receding before you. Even if your sin, like dirt farmers in Sherman's path, had been simply to live in the wrong place, you suffered. Didn't matter whether you owned slaves, or which way you voted, or how good your intentions had been, or how bad. You might suffer as much as the family of a great plantation, which was maybe not completely just, but if you were the family with a great plantation, you had it coming. Those were times that required choosing a side. And then sooner or later, history asks, which side were you on? The first sound of a culture collapsing from its highest steeple starts as a whisper, a sigh, the rattle of windows in their frames. Nobody listens until it thunders, when its structure, all the massive weight held in air as by a magician's trick, depending on sleight of hand, misdirection of attention, collapses to its foundational sins. And after the steeples have fallen, warred over landscapes lie burned and salted as thoroughly as Troy after the Greeks sailed home. Nothing left but frail and temporary and untrustworthy memory to image what stood before. Even near the end, many in the capital and elsewhere remained unsure whether they were engaged in a grand experiment or a pathetically inept confidence game, projecting boundaries of a new and uncertain country onto the landscape, north and south like grotesque reflections of one another in a carnival mirror. Sad and stupid. And yet, what? That London evening, sitting in the armchair with the stain where many heads had rested, V felt not at all happy, but calmer. Irresistible gravity settling her into place. How lovely to live alone, without the constant pull against attention, the strong outgoing tide dragging concentration away. Husband and ocean away, and the children happy in school, the boys in America and the girls across the channel learning French. V began writing a letter. She first thought to spill out pages of recollections and resentments, tracing how their lives had year by year ramified beyond prediction, or even the prophecy of nightmare, moving like a river in reverse, flowing from the mainstream out into so many branches that not a drop made it down to the sea. How they had lived rootless, homeless as fugitives until they became actual fugitives with an entire nation in pursuit. But instead, she wrote, "Dearest Jeff, of course I live to serve you and children. All loved and missed beyond excess, goes without saying. But still, to be alone in this beautiful, dirty old city after the calamity of the past years, and feeling nothing but a lift from letting go the faded glories, letting go youth and desire and hope, yet to sense a possible future rather than only a lurking ending, that thing with the weight of a great black riverboat and its stern wheel beating like a scythe and the added force of a booming Mississippi current that bore down on us for years and finally swept us under. So, right now, I wish you every day a happy day and good appetite, warm feet, good friends, and everything but forgetfulness. I do not think I would have longed for or used the water of Leith. Memory is truly possession sometimes. Stay away from me until autumn, and then see if we may feel we have a future together. Devotedly, your wife, V. V scans a pair of pages in James's blue book and says, "My name in print always arrests my eye. Listen to this. A little mulatto boy has been sent to General Saxton by Mrs. Jefferson Davies, and now the question came up, what was the best thing to do with him? He was about 7 years old, but small for his age, was a very light mulatto, with brown curly hair, thin lips, and a defiant nose. When brought before us, he looked around suspiciously and fearlessly. When Mrs. Saxton called him, he walked calmly up to her. But when I held out my hand to him, he folded his arms and stood still, straight as an arrow, with his head thrown back, without meeting my friendly advances. It was comical to see the cool indifference of this tiny scrap of humanity." V stops and says, "Scrap of humanity? Where did she come up with that? Dragged it out of nowhere. You were an intense little boy, and more than covered the ground you stood on. And you were not small for your age, and you were not 7. And also, I didn't send you away. I did the best I could in a horrible moment. I kept you with me all the way from Richmond, every mile. We were being held on board the William P. Clyde at Hilton Head, prisoners, not knowing which prison awaited us." She describes to James the Tuscarora lying alongside the Clyde, with big guns aimed to blow them out of the water in case the prisoners commandeered the ship. The prisoners included V and the children and 6 skeletal Jeff and Vice President Stevens, who weighed 90 pounds and looked like a mummified child and was called the Pale Star of Georgia by some of the papers. Also Clement and Virginia Clay. Clement had been both a U.S. senator and a Confederate senator. Late in the war, Jeff sent him on a spy mission to Canada. He came back looking like a hollow-cheeked killer, face like an axe blade, and greasy hair to his shoulders, not at all like his plump young face on the $1 bill. And of course, Burton Harrison was a prisoner, Jeff's private secretary through most of the war, and Verena's friend, companion, ally. They'd mostly taken different paths from Richmond to being prisoners on the Clyde. Jeff had stayed in Richmond until hours before the city burned, and then he escaped by railway with the cabinet to Danville, and then Greensboro, where they set up government in people's parlors. From there, Jeff traveled on horseback through the Carolinas and Georgia, plotting most of the way how he could prolong the war. Burton, though, had stuck with V from Richmond all through the horrible flight south, trying to get to Cuba. Horses and wagons, camping in tents, or in the wagon beds if it was raining too hard to set up camp. Sometimes sleeping in abandoned buildings or wayside churches. "After they captured us," V tells James, "they hauled us back north through Georgia and then east to the coast. They paraded us through jeering crowds in Macon and Augusta and Savannah. At the last minute before the ship departed, they pulled you away. The children and Ellen and I were screaming and crying, leaning over the rails of the Clyde. Ellen and I tried to convince them that you were her child because you were both about the same color. But they wrestled you onto a skiff. You fought and tried to jump into the water. Virginia Clay was crying too, and she tossed coins from her purse down into the skiff. I remember at some point Jeffy fell to his knees and held his cap over his face, not wanting to see what was happening. I begged them to send you to General Saxton in Charleston. In Washington, before the war, he often dined with us. One night, when it seemed that war was the only course our politicians, including my husband, had left open, I joked with Rufus Saxton that if he came to Mississippi leading an invading army, I would vow to see his grave was kept clean. I believed he would honor that old friendship and take care of you. There was a young Northern officer there who hated me and would have tossed you out by the roadside just to punish me. I had to keep you out of his hands and did all I could in that moment. Otherwise, I pictured you wandering through the chaos, starving and alone, put in more danger by being with me. James Blake says, I only remember boats, gray water and blue sky, silver coins flashing and tinkling in the air and splashing in the water. V says, 100,000 tragedies played out in the spring of 1865. We'd bet everything on anger and angry ideas, and we lost. Lee once wrote Jeff a letter during a particularly nasty little moment of decision in which he advised against action that he feared would bring down the reproach of our consciences and posterity's judgment. But by then it was too late to apply Lee's advice more widely because we were in the middle of trying to pull apart a country to protect the wealth of slave owners. There was no going back. Bad, angry decisions left behind a huge cost in life and suffering for the entire nation, an utter loss of wealth for the South. But not for the North. Plenty made fortunes off the war. Give a real Yankee one little dried pea and three thimbles, and he can buy groceries. Give him a box full of cheap, shiny pocket knives and pistols to trade, and he will turn it into a career. But give him a war, and he'll make a fortune to last centuries. It's not something they learn. They're saturated in it from birth. End result, we lose everything. And they create thousands of new millionaires. Bitter feelings still, ma'am. No. The people who beat you get to take you apart however they wish. Certainly sounds bitter. It's reality. We lost. I've lived in New York City for more than 15 years, and it's been good for me. I've made much of my living writing for the papers and have learned a great deal there, and in London, too. It does your mind good to talk to people different from you, especially instructive in regard to opinions about owning people and trying to kill a country. I've come to accept that our debt may stretch to one of those generational Bible curses, unto the seventh son of the seventh son, born on the seventh hour of the seventh day. I don't believe that's from the Bible. I'm sure it's in there somewhere, V says. Seven is a powerful number. James says, in South Carolina, the Sea Islands, the year after the war, I announced that Mr. Davis was a fine man, and the black children I was in school with fought me, backed me up against a wall. And then before long, I was in a northern school with nothing but white children, Massachusetts, and when I said Jefferson Davis was a fine man, they called me every derogatory racial name they knew and fought me. It's all here in Miss Botoum's book. I'm certain you stood up and fought back. You were a strong-minded child. But I'm sharing personal memories with you, and all you're doing is telling me things from a book. So please, tell me something you remember that's not from the book. James pauses and then says, pictures, mostly. Steep steps and high ceilings. A big room with the other children. Tall windows looking down to a lawn. A fierce red rocking horse bouncing in a frame with four big metal springs, and I pinched my hand in a spring and bled. I picture children sitting on a staircase, looking down through balusters to a party, with people wearing black and white clothes listening to music, a piano and a violin, an enormous green field, all of us running and spinning and blue sky whirling. Another time, a room and a fire, loud flashes of lightning, people yelling, babies crying. Yes, V says. Every bit of that. The day you fled Richmond, some might have kissed me goodbye and sent me on my way, back to being a stray. Maybe so, But I held on to you until I realized keeping you with me was worse for you than letting you go. That long trip south, James says, I wish I remembered more of it. Oh, I'll tell you everything you want to know. Write a book if you feel like it. Everybody seems to be inventing their own history and finding a publisher. Just don't write a tiresome biography. They all end the same way. But it's getting late, and since Albany is so nearby, we might reconvene to talk more next Sunday. Of course. Come about noon. I'll arrange lunch here, or maybe we'll picnic at the races. I like to see the little jockeys in their silk clothes, and the green grass and white fences and big trees. But mostly I love looking at the horses beforehand more than the race itself. I rode well when I was young and can see things in their eyes and facial expressions and deportment that tell me how they feel about running that day. Sometimes I just know it's their day, a feeling not like a wave raging and breaking, but a smooth swell almost ready to curl over. I bet a few dollars at a time and win more than I lose. I pay for my entertainment. As James stands to leave, V says, When I was younger, I might have dreamed your arrival beforehand, like I did that place where we were all captured. Every feature of South Georgia landscape exact. The road, the swale down to a creek, pine trees, fallow fields, even the placement of the tents on either side of the road. But that gift, or curse, left me soon after the war. I still have vivid dreams, but now they never correspond with reality. Second Sunday. Saratoga Springs. The Saratoga Railway Station pulses with race day foot traffic, the energy of hope funneling people out the doors and toward the track. James Blake, blue book in hand, weaves his way to a clear space at the end of the platform. That scream down the hall of the retreat repeats in his head. He's tried all week to decode the tone, whether it arose from some specific marital fight or from general anger, anguish, fear, frustration with life. He raises a finger to a red cap porter and asks the man about the retreat. What kind of place? Surely just what it appeared, an exclusive resort hotel. The red cap is about 50, not tall, but big-shouldered from shifting baggage all day for 30 years. Brass buttons shine bright down the breast of his uniform jacket. He is darker than James by several degrees. He studies James carefully and says, Looking to take a room? No. Good. You're not close enough to passing to test them. Sundown's probably their borderline. Like little towns bragging no black man ever spent the night there and lived to tell it. Except polite about it. Plenty welcome during daylight hours to build roads, lay brick, plow gardens, clean houses, swing 9-pound hammers. James says, Last Sunday, about this time, they let me sit in the lobby. But they made sure I knew it was grudging. I'll be back for the 6:35 to Albany. I just need to know what the place is. Hotel. People stay there because it's nice. The view and the food and the service. But they've got doctors. Guests can get treatments. Treatments for what? I couldn't tell you what ailments those people come down with. Tired of living, mainly. Must get dreary having nothing useful to do. James laughs and says, Thank you, sir. You've set me straight. He reaches out a coin, and the man pinches it out of habit, but then lets go. He says, Save that for the retreat. Might need it. The Ophelia in the guest's upcoming production of Hamlet, a woman of 20 or so named Laura, stops by V's room. She doesn't knock, but opens the door and drifts right in without a word. She wears a thin nightgown and light shawl and goes barefoot, though the day is coming toward mid-morning. Her hair, a beautiful blonde tussle, holds light from the window in an aura around her face. She is the youngest daughter from a cigarette paper fortune, and her skin stretches over her bones pale and thin as the diaphanous rectangles that pay for therapy to ease her only two defects, which are that she sometimes seems to be hearing conversations different from the ones actually taking place, and that she sometimes becomes excessively demonstrative in her attraction to men. She comes to V's chair and without a word climbs into her lap and wraps her arms around V's neck and rests her head on V's chest. She draws a long, deep breath and hums a bit of Sunflower Slow Drag, her fingers twitching to press imaginary keys. Soon she falls asleep. Her bony body relaxes and settles deep against V. Her skinny feet hang almost to the floor. V brushes her lips against the mass of blonde hair and tries to shape her mind still as a mud puddle on a windless day. Tries to sit and wait quiet inside her head until the particulates settle to the dirty bottom and the water becomes clear as glass. But no matter how much she instructs her thoughts toward stillness, they circle, loop, and repeat, churning against themselves, white water climbing and spraying over rocks already passed. When V returns to New York, she plans to seek instruction on this topic from a yogi or some other Eastern mystic. The city is full of them lately. Or maybe she'll find a piano teacher to remind her how to play, and she'll sit doodling repetitive minor key largos for a couple of hours a day to shape her mind in a helpful, calm direction. Laura wakes after perhaps half an hour and looks up. Her eyes are hazel with striae dark as walnut. She says, "Did you come to me, or did I come to you?" Her voice vibrates with a thin, hoarse crack. "The latter," V says. "Has breakfast been served?" "Some time ago. Luncheon will be in a couple of hours." "Oh, good. I could nap longer." Laura breathes deep, one cycle through her mouth and two through her nose, and then she's gone again. V reaches to her wrist and presses her middle finger into the tangle of bone and grizzle to find a heartbeat. The girl throbs at long intervals. V tries to number the beats, saying, 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi. She gets 30 beats a minute, which doesn't seem right. Not even possible. V worries the girl will die in her arms, and she doesn't need another gone child. Laura smells like cut rye grass and ripe pears and a pillowcase needing washing. The skin of her cheeks is poreless and white as a piece of everyday china. She weighs nothing, rests against V like a goose down pillow. Laura doesn't remind V of her own children in the least, but she does call back youth, like holding a pale version of her own young self. V leans to Laura's ear and breathes, fainter than a whisper, an arrangement of three words. Be well, get well. She says it over and over like a prayer, a chant, an old mystic rhythm that, if repeated long enough, works magic. At some point, V may have fallen asleep too, or at least into a daze, watching the patterns of light through the window, a vertical rectangle of landscape, shades of green and blue, ridgeline and sky. The changes of light through the day happen in such slow rhythms that you have to pay strict attention to follow the melody. At least she doesn't get bored, wishing she could reach 10 feet to the nearest book. Each ticking minute tingles with life, sheltering this sad girl, her shallow breaths and slow heart, abandoned by her family to the questionable authority of the self-satisfied alienists and mesmerists and semi-doctors at the retreat. Laura is lonely, alone, isolate. V keeps breathing the spell. Be well, get well. Laura shifts her legs a bit and the bottoms of her feet present themselves. Ivory, amber, and coal dust. Her shanks glow tight along the shin bone, a blonde shimmer of fine hair down the slack muscle of the calf. V holds this body with its reluctant spark of life inside, compassed by such a frail container of skin, all its messy fluids and mysterious, greasy, dark organs held within a membrane hardly more substantive than a soap bubble. Touch it gently, and it pops, gone to nothing. V says, "It feels like rain. So next week for the races?" "Whatever you think, Mrs. Davis." "Could we talk to each other without Mrs. and Ma'am? We have such a short time together, and manners only slow us down." "What should I call you, then?" "You be James, and I'll be Verena." "I don't think I can do that." "Yes, you can. If we hadn't been separated back then, what would we be calling each other now?" "I don't know." "Neither do I. But if we'd reached Havana, we might be sitting under palm trees beside the Caribbean talking in Spanish, your pretty children calling me abuela. So for today, let's try James and Verena. If others come around listening in, snooping for gossip, we can go back to Mr. and Mrs. for a minute. We could exaggerate the way we say it and laugh about it later. Booker T. Washington and I made all the newspapers just sitting together talking for an hour or two in a hotel lobby in New York City, trying to discuss education, except people kept hovering, eavesdropping, and at some point we both started laughing. "All right, Verena," James says. "I have a question. Is this a hotel or a hospital?" She sweeps her hand to encompass the sun terrace and says, "Look around, James. Guests fashionably dressed, nearly as fashionably as you. Nobody wearing a straitjacket, just having drinks and food in the afternoon. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it looks like a hotel. Except last week, I thought I heard someone scream." "Words fail," V says. "To live is to rant." She announces the idea as if she had composed it and honed it down over time and rehearsed her delivery, meaning for it to be carved directly underneath Emerson's attempt to reconcile guilt and fear. Or perhaps she meant to scratch it with a nail on a smaller stone off to the side, a sort of marginal annotation. Then she laughs and says, "James, people like to gossip about the retreat. All it amounts to is that therapies are offered. It's the fashion." She runs down the possibilities. Hydrotherapy, just a fancy name for a very hot or very cold bath. Physiotherapy, nothing but relaxing massages, taking walks and carriage rides. A bowling alley in a basement, badminton on the lawn for those still able to jump around, and recent talk of converting cow pastures into golf links. Mechanotherapy, a room full of ugly exercise machines, but always a line of ladies waiting for the vibrating Xander apparatus. Electrotherapy, though, causes her to lower her voice. She barely breathes. How way back in the basement, they're playing around with a dark speculation of Benjamin Franklin's about the possible benefits of passing strong electric shock through the human head. Franklin took a jolt hard enough to rob him of consciousness, and when he came to, he felt unusually fine. He theorized amnesia relieves melancholia, which makes complete sense, because memory is so often to blame for it. Who couldn't use their load of time and history lightened? She explains how the hotel even makes putting on a short play therapeutic, dramatotherapy. Says that she and some other guests are doing an abbreviated Hamlet soon, and a man who makes moving pictures is coming from New York to film it, so that they can look at it later and laugh at themselves. In Richmond during the war, B says, Mary Chestnut and I put on after-dinner comic theatricals and made famous people like Jeb Stuart, the great plumed hero straight off the battlefield, claim a role and join in. He loved it, always demanded the silliest part and played for laughs. So did Judah Benjamin, the Attorney General, or Secretary of State, or Secretary of War, or whatever job he held that week in the improvised government. Jeff, of course, headed to bed or his office before the fun started. And fun, not therapy, was all we claimed for our evening entertainment, a chance to laugh. I don't remember any of that, James says. Well, V says cheerfully, I'm sure you children sneaked downstairs to watch a time or two. It wasn't all formal dress and serious music. But my main point is, we're volunteers at the retreat. We choose our therapies from printed lists exactly like the menus in the dining room. Most of us want to lose a few pounds or to drink less so that we don't have to stop drinking altogether. Some want to become a little less fearful and a little more brave, less despondent and more hopeful. As for me, I want any improvement I can get, but I'll settle for cutting back on the powders and tinctures. Not stop, just moderate. Interesting, for the first time since I was 13, to have a doctor helping me ease up on opiates instead of recommending more. But if I keep living to my 85th birthday, I plan to start taking them as freely as Mary Chestnut. What do you want to get away from? Saratoga isn't the wilderness, James. I'm not running. I did plenty of that the first half of my life. I spent a day with a newspaper writer a few weeks ago. The article they published said I was old, but still liked to keep up with new books and to play cards and go to the races. If I wanted to run away, why would I talk to a reporter? I mean, personally, one thing you'd put behind you forever if you could. Take a wild guess. The war, and all the things surrounding it. There. Asked and answered. V leans and lifts the shaggy book from the table. She riffles pages. Bookmarks flutter. I imagine you'd like to get back to this. Compare Miss Botoum's imagination against mine. Try to construct your own memory. Yes, I'd like to know about you and Mr. Davis. Particularly him letting me stay there, living in the same big room with his children, joining them with their tutor, learning to read. Me living like that in the presidential mansion of the Confederate States of America seems... James pauses, searches for the words, and finally says dryly, of a low order of probability. V smiles and says, you can take your tongue out of your cheek. However unlikely it did happen. He went to the courthouse himself to get papers verifying you were free. We had photographs of all the children taken not long after you came. Maybe they still exist. I hope so. You're in them, standing plump-cheeked, wearing a little striped suit. I don't know why he didn't object to you being there. Maybe because he didn't have the energy to fight the war and me at the same time. To be able to live together, we learned to pick our battles. Really, in blunt terms, my question is simple. If I'd been darker, would he have let you keep me? Would he have picked that battle? Again, I don't think you need me to answer that question. What about you? Would you have stopped my beating and taken me home? Included me in the family pictures? Taken me with you, fleeing Richmond? Fleeing America, to be precise. Would you have done it? Truth? James nods. I don't know, V says. I hope so. Did we leave Richmond on a train? The other day, I thought I remembered sleeping on a wood bench in a passenger car. Not Bearwood, but a bad trip from the start, B says. At least I had my little suicide pistol to comfort me. Falling Apart, March 1865. At the station, a stub of train waited, a locomotive with a wood car, baggage car, and one old unpainted passenger car fitted with red velvet upholstery worn silvery bald in patches. V and Ellen and the children settled in. The Trenholm girls, beautiful daughters of the Secretary of the Treasury, one of the richest men in America before the war, arrived like they were embarking on a pleasure cruise. The only men were Burton Harrison, Jefferson's secretary, and James Morgan, an officer, both in their 20s. Morgan had been yanked out of the trenches of Petersburg for this mission because Jefferson, still sometimes a romantic, knew love brewed between Morgan and one of the Trenholm girls and didn't want him to be among the last to die. Burton had accompanied V on all her emergency flights from Richmond as protector, assistant, substitute husband, and they had long since become tight friends. For the children, V and Ellen made pallets of quilts on the floor between the rows of seats. Maggie and Billy and Jeffy and Jimmy lay down and pulled covers to their eyebrows. Jefferson came aboard and kissed cheeks and made assurances, wished Morgan and the Trenholm girls bon voyage. He took Burton with him onto the platform, and they talked pretty urgently. V sat next to Ellen and took her hand and said, "You don't have to go with me. If it's better for you to stay here, then stay." Ellen sat a long time looking down at the floor before saying, "There's not anything here for me, and you can't handle all the children by yourself. Coming with me could get very bad. Bad here, too, with no money, and food scarce till crops start growing. And besides, if it does get bad, the children will need us both." Somewhere in the night, only an hour or two below Petersburg, the locomotive broke down. No explosion of steam or clash of metal. They coasted quietly to a stop in dark woods, and then sat through dawn and sunset and another dawn before finally rolling again. 4 days in all to cover less than 300 miles to Charlotte, during which time the provisional nation crumbled and many people died. Sherman's army still raged north after the burning of Columbia, and no one knew what civilian target they would destroy next. Word of V's arrival in Charlotte preceded them, and an angry, howling mob waited at the station. People already beaten in war and now standing at a cliff edge with nowhere to go but down. Among them, deserters and draftees and relatives of the pointlessly dead. Manners collapsed into rage. They saw V through the car window and began reviling. They shouted curses largely aimed at her husband, but since he wasn't present to absorb them, she would have to do. Burton convinced V and Ellen and the children to move away from the windows and huddle with the Trenholm girls in a corner, where they kept their courage up by making exaggerated, shocked expressions at each angry vulgarity. V pulled her little weapon out, and then realized the ammunition was packed away in a trunk, since she hadn't anticipated needing to kill herself in Charlotte. Burton and Morgan had just a pistol and a sword between them. They stood inside the door to the car, and when a few brave mobsters climbed the steps, Burton showed his pistol and said, "No." If 10 men had decided to board the car and do whatever their rage told them to do once inside, they could have stormed the door and succeeded, losing only 2 or 3 men. But no one wanted to go first. They backed off and shouted a few minutes more about killing Jeff Davis and the whole bunch of rich slave owners their friends and family had died for. Soon, they lost interest and drifted away. Burton went door to door through Charlotte looking for lodging at hotels and private homes, but everyone feared retribution, whether from their own angry people or from Sherman if he swept through killing and burning. The same people would have treated V like the Queen of England 12 months before. Burton finally found a man named Weil, who said he would be glad to offer shelter. The Trenholm girls and Morgan were moving on, the train set to take them as far down the line as it could toward their house in upstate South Carolina, the Charleston house being out of the question because of Sherman. One of the girls said, "Come join us. We'll have a house party till they burn us out. Drink all the best wine to keep the Yankees from getting it." Burton escorted V and Ellen and the children through the angry streets of Charlotte to Mr. Wiles' house. In the following days, they stayed hidden away, though Burton went out once gathering scraps of news and rumor. The fall of Richmond, the flight of the government, Lee handing his sword to Grant at Appomattox. "I still have that little pistol," V says. "I keep it in my jewelry box." "I can't imagine, whatever the danger, sending Julie away like that. If it was bad enough to give her a pistol to kill herself with, it would have been bad enough for me to walk away from everything else and try to take her someplace safe." "Our situation was more complicated," V says. "Jeff being president of a rebel country." "Yes, but all that was over. How many days after we left Richmond did he go?" "I don't know. 3 or 4. "And he didn't catch up with us for how long?" "Going on 2 months. And again, it's a point of pride that we could probably have made it to Cuba if he hadn't caught up with us." James says, "I told you last week about defending him against black children in South Carolina and white children in Massachusetts and both groups of them fighting me. But all I remember of him is a slim, older white man in a suit. He was much older than you, and I've been wondering how you came together." "It was briars and hurricanes, right from the start," B says. Hurricane and Briarfield, 1842. She grew up outside Natchez in an old-fashioned house called the Briars. A house, not a plantation. No fields, no cotton. It sat on a few acres of high bluff, overlooking the Mississippi. The ground sloped east to a dry bayou 100 feet deep, its sides covered with pines and live oaks and magnolia trees. To the west, deep, yellow clay bluffs caved to the river below. The proportions of the house felt right, oversized windows and broad shady galleries across the front and back. But it was largely the river that made it beautiful. Growing up, she witnessed every day all the dirty business of cotton and slaves, all the criminality and culture of the new country passing in miniature below her on the big brown river. Everything that floated, dugout canoes and vast timber rafts and every kind of John boat, flatboat, keelboat and barge all the way to giant white paddle wheel steamboats, coasted down current or struggled up. Nights when she was young, looking down from the lawn of the Briars, steamboats passed below her, lit up like Christmas. They trailed faint sounds of music and the distant grinding and churning of their great paddle wheels. She stood barefoot in the damp grass and watched their unreal passage below her, as if Venus had shifted its orbit and swooped by, a luminous world of its own here and gone in minutes, leaving the blank space of wide river even quieter and darker than before. At least once a month, from 12 onward, dreams rode her nights, prophetic, horrific, beautiful, mysterious. She never claimed they came true. Others did that. And during the Washington and Richmond years, she became famous for them. Most of them were no more important than any